From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the winter of 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee. Sanitation workers had been asking for safer working conditions, better equipment, more pay. And then one night it rained hard, and two sanitation workers took shelter from the rain in the back of their truck. The truck malfunctioned, and both men were crushed to death. Their deaths pushed their colleagues to march, to organize and demand change. But the city of Memphis not only refused, the city even refused to provide compensation to the families of the dead workers. That's when 1,300 of their colleagues decided to walk off the job. According to labor historians, the strike kicked off successfully with a several hundred person sit-in, which led the city council to acknowledge the sanitation workers' union and support raises. But the mayor of Memphis stood firm. No raises, no changes. Then on February 23, 1968, police confronted peaceful protesters with tear gas. As the Smithsonian notes, until Memphis, both the NAACP and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had focused mainly on racial equality. The sanitation worker strike broadened their efforts to advocate for workers' rights. This was part of a more significant trend of the time. Steve Estes is the author of I Am a Man, Race, Manhood, and the Civil Rights Movement. He said, quote, class had always been an issue in the civil rights movement, but in the late 60s, it was having to deal with it explicitly, end quote. This cause was well aligned with MLK's priorities at the time. He was building the Poor People's Campaign to advocate for underprivileged Americans of diverse races. So Dr. King went to Memphis. On March 18th, he spoke to a crowd of 25,000 people. He talked about dignity, the value of labor, and why he supported the strike. He said, quote, whenever you are engaged in work that serves humanity and is for the building of humanity, it has dignity and it has worth, end quote. But those workers didn't feel they were being treated with dignity. The city of Memphis paid sanitation workers 65 cents an hour at the time, a wage so low that many were eligible for food stamps. They were not paid overtime. On April 3rd, King returned to Memphis and delivered his last speech, I've Been to the Mountaintop. As his personal letters have noted, King was thinking a lot at the time about the possibility of his own death. Threats were coming in every day. In Memphis, he said, quote, what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers? Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, end quote. And you might conclude that King was almost fatalistic at that point, but look at what else he said to workers on the night of April 3rd. He said, quote, we've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. Nothing would be more tragic than to stop at this point in Memphis, end quote. The next day, an assassin killed Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The workers' rights movement has never forgotten the cause that MLK was working toward when he was murdered. So now, on the 56th anniversary of the assassination, the Rochester Labor Council is screening a documentary about his final days. We discuss parallels and disconnects between the labor movement during King's era and the labor movement today. What can we learn from that? If you want to see the film, it's showing at 5:30 tonight at The River I Stand, 5:30 tonight, at Rock Cinema, and we'll tell you all the details coming up. Let me welcome our guests who have helped organize this. Welcome back to Jim Bertolone. It's been a little while. President Emeritus of the Rochester Labor Council, former president and a labor historian for APWU. Welcome, sir. Nice to see you, Jim.
Thanks, Evan. Good to be here.
Welcome to Sharifa Pryor, the chair of the Rochester Labor Council Racial Justice Committee and a member of CSEA. Sharifa, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Orlando Torres is vice president of AFSCME Local 1635 City Employees Union. He's a local sanitation worker. Orlando, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Jim Bertolone, why didn't I know this story until you all made me dig into the history on it here? I mean, I knew a little bit, but I certainly didn't realize just how deeply entwined MLK had become in his final days with the labor movement.
It actually goes back. One of Martin Luther King's heroes was the great civil rights and labor leader, A. Philip Randolph.
I love your voice, but get that mic closer to you.
Okay.
There you go.
A. Philip Randolph of the Sleeping Car Porters Union and a civil rights leader in his own right. And A. Philip Randolph was also one of the principals with Bayard Rustin of the March on Washington in August 1963. Of their 10 demands at the March on Washington in 63, number one was equal rights. Number two was a minimum wage that was a living wage. You know, going back to the sit-ins, in Greensboro, Martin Luther King was known for saying, what good is integrating a lunch counter if you can't afford the hamburger they're serving? And he spoke at many prior to his death. The sanitation worker strike was about not only helping them, but kicking off what was to be his Poor People campaign. But he had spoke at many unions conventions and many AFL-CIO conventions for years, and was very close to Walter Reuther of the UAW, and they both came together to be principals on the left for the presidential 89-day campaign, unfortunately, of Robert Kennedy in 68.
Sharifa, what do you make of, before we kind of get into the specifics of the story, what do you make of the importance of understanding how Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was spending his final days?
I think it's very important to know that he was still fighting to his last days. The fact that, you know, with the threats that he was still getting, that he felt that it was important for the people to know that he's still in the fight for them, that he went to Memphis to let people know that I'm still here, despite the threats that he was getting. It just shows the tenacity in him that he still care, that he's still there. And it just definitely shows that.
How do you see it, Orlando? I mean, not only from your position as the vice president of VASME Local 1635, but from your work in sanitation. I know that you feel some solidarity even probably today with the people that MLK was working with and for there.
Yeah, the story really touches home, you know, being out in the environment. And, you know, you compare, obviously, today's technology with back then. Big difference, but... You know, when you sit back and you watch and you hear the stories of people who, you know, work during these tough times, you know, it touches home, like I said, because of the fact that you can relate. I know I can relate being out in the winter, rain, snow, hot, cold, whatever it is, you know, we're out there. We're on the front line when it came to, you know, cleaning up the city and taking care of the sanitation in the city of Rochester. So it's really a sad story when you really learn the history behind everything, what they went through. And, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, losing the two individuals who lost their lives at the time to really push the movement even further and harder. So,
Orlando, one thing that is not clear, and when I went back and was reading speeches and what the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was saying to the crowd, and he came to Memphis multiple times in his final weeks. It wasn't always clear to me in reading his words if he was directing his speech directly to the sanitation workers or to the general public to hear about the idea of the dignity of work. But can I just ask you a little bit of how you take his words and maybe how you think about the dignity of work, having done sanitation work yourself, having perhaps heard stereotypes that people may have. How do you hear his words, and who do you think they were directed at when he talked about the dignity and the value of labor?
I think he was definitely making it widespread throughout. You know, he wanted the world to know, or the people at the time paying attention to this movement, that the importance of humanity. I mean, one of the big things of the strikes and in the marches was "I am a man," was mm-hmm. one of the most famous posters at the time that people were wearing around their necks, walk around. It was letting the world know that, you know, we are human beings, we have lives, we have families to support, you know, we deserve better, we deserve more, we deserve people to respect us, no matter if we're sitting behind a desk or we're out here throwing garbage cans around. You know, they wanted people to know that they are human beings. So I think it was just very widely spread to let the community and everybody who was very unaware of what they were going through to really realize, you know, how big of this movement was going to be for history.
That was a driving slogan of the time, "I am a man," mm-hmm. which to my ears speaks to the fact that hundreds, if not well over 1,000 sanitation workers felt that they were not viewed as human beings. Have you felt in your own work as a sanitation worker, have you ever felt dehumanized?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we get... From being in the middle of rush hour traffic in the morning to be, you know, with our big trucks in the way and, you know, people beeping at us and yelling at us for you know, causing gridlock in the streets, stuff like that. You know, we work on all city residential streets from the main roads to the side streets. So there's times where, you know, people have literally have gotten out their cars and run around the truck and yelled at me to, you know, get your vehicle out the way. I'm trying to get to work. And, you know, you're just a, you know, a stupid garbage man in a way, you know, a lot of stuff you hear, but, you know, we're I would say trained in a way to deal with the public. You know, you never really want to go back and forth with a city residential person, but
is it hard sometimes?
Oh, it definitely is. I mean, I've had some incidences where people have literally driven up around my truck onto front lawns over sidewalks to get past my vehicle so they can continue on upon their day. I've had people come up, kick a garbage can over next to me, you know, yelling at me, get out the way. We've had individuals, not myself, but have been put in situations where people have come up and threatened them with, you know, different items, a bat, stuff like that. You know, we've had incidents where people have been in the middle of gun battles, you know, in the streets of Rochester. Sometimes it's a little tougher to be really, really out there at certain times of the day. We've had BB guns shot at us. There's just a lot you deal with the public, and unfortunately some people are just not big fans of the big yellow and green garbage trucks in the streets certain times of the day.
A couple things, Orlando. I mean, I love this idea that there's so much traffic and how dare you get in the middle of it. I mean, it's hard enough to get around Rochester. Mm-hmm. As everybody knows, we're the most traffic gridlocked city in the world. Or we are not. Actually, it's actually usually easy to get anywhere you want in the city. And I think people just feel entitled to always be able to have the road at their pleasure. But also, when you say that you're kind of trained to kind of bite your tongue, is that for your own protection? Can you tell me a little bit about the mentality of how you deal with that?
Well, you got to remember, while you're out there, you still represent the city of Rochester. We're city of Rochester employees. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're expected to carry ourselves a certain way, handle situations a certain way. We're taught to never get engaged in conversation, you know, that you can see it's going to lead to something bigger than what it actually should be. But We've had sit downs and training sessions where we're taught, you know, how to deal with the public in a way that you can continue about your day safely. Most importantly, it's most important that, you know, we also tell our members when we deal with management, and most important thing is that our individuals, our members, get home back to their family safely. So it's something that the city pushes, and it's very important that you never engage with, you know, a person in the city at times.
If it's 56 years after Memphis, after that strike and that movement, after the assassination of MLK, why are we still hung up on treating some people with dignity for the work that they do? What do you think?
That's a tough one. I mean, it is
a tough question.
Yeah, it's a tough question.
Because, I mean, we're still here. We're still fighting for equal pay, better health care. I mean, it's still a fight.
Yeah. And again, with, you know, the world we live in with the inflation, there's always move for improvement on wages and, you know, things to better the employee, to allow them to continue to support their families and be able to grow in their careers. Nowadays, you know, anybody who earns, you know, a $50,000 salary is still considered, you know, with a family of four or more, is a poverty pay. Just that the ways that, you know, inflation and everything around us is going up so much that, you know, we always strive to get what's best and work on, you know, making sure that our members and the workers out in the field are treated with fairness and, you know, equal wages across the board, no matter, you know, what, if we're in 2024 or 50 years from now, you know, that's the goal.
Let me ask Jim a little bit about that question, and then we're going to talk about a wide range of issues pertaining to labor, the dignity of work, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and the on this anniversary of that day. There is a film, At the River I Stand, a documentary film that is just about an hour long that focuses on not only the sanitation workers' 1968 fight for dignity and a living wage in Memphis, but also the final days of MLK and this story that I think a lot of us, at least I'll put my hand in the air and say I'm part of this group who knew just a little but not very much about this. Jim, on the subject of dignity, how do you think our society is doing?
Not as well as I would hope. Some of that, I think, is what we've seen with the expansion of social media, and people believe who free speech that even if what they're saying is not true, they've got a right to say it or believe it. And I think the other reason, one other reason is, I don't get paid to do this, so they can't accuse me of collusion, but we don't have enough Evan Dawsons in the media. The mainstream media is more and more concerned with their shareholders and profits. We've seen dozens of local newspapers close every month, every week. We've seen the reduction in local reporters here. People don't seem to know that, like in 1968, the sanitation workers, we still have thousands and thousands of workers who die on the job every year or die from exposures at their workplace, and nobody knows it. And we've already forgotten, it seems, a pandemic when before we had a vaccine, that some of our lowest paid workers in agriculture and grocery store, nurses' aides, hospital aides, transportation, they all went to work. Many of them got very sick. Some of them died. And we started finally calling them essential workers. And now that that's behind us, it looks like everybody's going to forget that history again. Mm.
You agree with that, Sharifa? Are you concerned about the same?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. I mean, we definitely need to go back to, like you said, the dignity of workers and calling them out as essential workers, because we all essential to the workplace.
So the film, and I have not seen this film. Our guests, have you all seen the film yet?
Yes. Yes, this actually is our second time showing this film.
Second time showing it. It's 5:30 tonight at Rock Cinema. Do you have an address for that, Sharifa?
Yes.
I think you do.
Yes, the address actually is 957 South Clayton Avenue.
And you're going to see in this hour-long film a number of different strands, including a debate and kind of the deployment of different tactics, of nonviolent tactics, of nonviolent protest. But this was a city in Memphis in 1968 that had two workers crushed to death in a truck. And we're still not only denying the change to workers, denying to pay overtime, denying to raise wages, denying to give any compensation to the families of the men who had been killed in a malfunctioning truck. And then we're deploying police to tear gas protesters. And can I ask all of you, you know, if that feels now far away, or if what I just described feels like it could be a 2024 story, how do you feel about that, Sharifa?
I mean, it could happen, you know? I mean, they're working, you know? The conditions of their work wasn't the best at the time. I mean, we have advanced as far as, you know, the mechanics of the trucks, like, you know, Orlando was saying, but there are still advancements that can be made at our workplace, like Jim was saying earlier. So things could still, you know, still happen. I feel like you can't put nothing past history, because history always repeats itself. So things could still happen. So, yes, things could still happen. I don't put past history. Actually still repeats itself to some extent.
What do you think, Orlando?
I think if you go back a few years, you know, with everything that took place with the George Floyd situation, stuff like that, and the impact it had on the community, it's hard to sit back and say, that's not going to happen in my city. Well, we saw it happen here when the incident took place with the individual here who lost his life based on being in the custody of police and what
Daniel Prude.
And you know, what progressed down here at downtown in front of the PSB building, and, you know, seeing police cars literally vandalized, and the march and the violence and just the stuff that, you know, was happening here in our city based off of the situation. So, like Sharifa said, I can't put it past anything nowadays that, you know, something so extreme could take place. But, you know, God forbid something did happen where an individual or somebody was hurt. You know, like in this situation with the movie, you know, they really complained about the malfunctioning of the vehicles that you'll see in the footage in the movie itself. Mm-hmm. They really kept going to management about, you know, the vehicles not being up to par. And unfortunately, it fell on deaf ears. And you know, we lost two individuals over a situation. So in today's you know, today's day, if something were to happen where something wasn't taken care of immediately based off of safety concerns, and, you know, unfortunately somebody were to lose their life, I don't see this something that this is that it is impossible here. I think it could happen.
How's your relationship with the city of Rochester?
Mayor Evans is huge on labor. He was part of, you know, we pushed for supporting him during his campaigning, and he was definitely huge on labor. Just like with any business, at end, there's always two sides to every story, and sometimes we have battles where we're able to settle stuff behind closed doors, and then sometimes, you know, we take advantage of what's out there as far as our sources and getting answers sooner than later. And for the most part, I think our relationship as a union standing with the city has been pretty well since he's been in office, and we're hoping to continue as his as a few years left goes on. And if he stays or not, you know, whoever comes into play after him, we just try and keep the labor movement alive. It's important. The city runs on the backs of, you know, a lot of our members. We pick up the sanitation, we take care of the water, we clean the streets, we plow the streets, we take care of city municipalities and buildings, we clean, we take care of the rec centers. We do a lot. I know our members are responsible for a lot of the functions in the city. And then obviously you have the RPD and the Rochester Fire Department, but, you know, those are on the backs of workers that keep the city going.
Jim, how do you feel about this 1968 story and whether it feels...
Well, I remember 1968, yeah. And I saw this week something similar to 1968. I saw a presidential candidate being endorsed by a bunch of police, claiming to be for law and order, right-wing police, in spite of the fact that this gentleman encouraged his supporters to severely injure 140 cops on January 6, 2021. In 1968, Richard Nixon had a Southern strategy that was racist and pro-Jim Crow. That's why it was called the Southern Strategy, a wink and a nod, and claimed to be the law and order president, and the message being there that they were going to crack down on civil rights protests and anti-war protests. And one of the two largest national police unions, Nixon wasn't racist and far right enough for him. They endorsed in 1968 George Wallace. And when I saw this presidential candidate standing with this police, that's immediately what I saw was 1968 and tens of thousands of police officers nationwide, not just in the South, endorsing George Wallace.
What do you think is driving that now, Jim?
Well, I think, you know, we say in labor and we said in the civil rights movement, the struggle continues. Anything worth changing won't change in your lifetime. You pass it on generation. And I always thought, you know, those who are familiar with the works of Frederick Douglass, Rochester's own Frederick Douglass, he made some great observations, but I always thought he only had half of one. And one of his most famous is, without struggle, there is no progress. And if it was up to me, I would finish that today, is without struggle, they will take every bit of progress back if they can. That's the rich and the powerful. They reverse it. So it's not only about progress, it's about defending where we've come.
We're talking about a documentary film that is showing tonight at 5:30, if you'd like to attend, at Rock Cinema. It's 5:30 tonight. It's At the River I Stand, about an hour-long film that details the final weeks of the life of Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King was joining in solidarity with Memphis sanitation workers who had been on strike after the death of two of their members and the refusal of Memphis government to pay them, I would say, not even a living wage, anything that was outside of a poverty wage, any overtime, et cetera. And it's also a story of how, if you feel like you know Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s story, it's important to understand how he spent those final weeks in true solidarity, multiple visits to these workers and to Memphis, and then some of his words specifically about the dignity and the value of work and the way systems work against that at times. And after we take this only break, I want to talk to our guests about how they see some other issues in the labor movement now, just how united they see the labor movement, perhaps locally or nationally. We haven't seen the numbers indicating a big spike in growth in the labor movement, but we've seen definitely in the last 5 years, we've seen more inquiries, more efforts to unionize, especially in different sectors, whether it's literally Starbucks to hospitals and nurses. So the interest in unionization publicly and privately is higher. The numbers don't necessarily reflect that. We're nowhere near the highs in the early 1980s. But we're going to talk more about how the movement is working and how the echoes of this film in 1968 are still with us. We'll come right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, City Magazine is all about cannabis in its April edition. This is our monthly visit with the team from City, and they're going to take us through cannabis from a wide range of angles, from, yes, dispensaries and farming, but also baked goods, beauty products, glass art, and more. All things cannabis with the City crew next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll get to your phone calls in a moment if you want to call the program as we talk about labor, the workers' movement, ties to 1968, Dr. King, and more. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Valerie emails to say, Evan, the theater, just say the cinema. That's how people know it. It's the thing. I mean, I've been calling it rock cinema. I mean, if you're not in Rochester and you haven't been there, but it's the cinema. 957 Clinton Avenue, 5:30 tonight. And it's At the River I Stand for this documentary to see in really sort of gripping video and audio these final weeks and this movement that had the attention of MLK. So 5:30 tonight for that. I'll get to your calls in a second. I do have another email, a listener saying that Tim says, your guests can talk about raising wages all they want, but soon enough, we're going to see AI replace a lot of these jobs. Okay. Thank you, Tim. And I will ask our guests about that. It's been on my mind this week because of all things on Monday night, Jon Stewart and The Daily Show did a little thing on AI. And they quoted Sumit Shah, who is the president of a company called Ducan. That's a company that has proudly used AI to lay off 90% of its employees. And here's what the CEO said. Sumit Shah told Fox News, quote, "Well, it is brutal, but only if you think like a human." So, you know, if you think like a robot or a machine, it's pretty good. If you think like a human, I guess, kind of brutal. I prefer to think like a human. And I want to ask our guests about, you know, some of the context. Jim, you talked about how difficult it is to move those in power to honor and dignify work, to honor it with better wages, et cetera. Now you've got a CEO saying, hey, we just laid off 90% of our workforce because we could with AI, but that's not so bad unless you're a human. And that kind of sent a little bit of a shiver down my spine, I admit. I thought that was pretty telling. So I want to ask what you think about that comment, but also what you make of Tim's remark that says, hey, a lot of these jobs are going to be replaced by AI anyway.
My 45 years of union advocacy went from my workplace from manual labor to mechanization to automation. So we've seen this, and adjustments have to be made for new job, new training, in search of profits, whether it's AI or something else. Management always is looking for this type of thing, even for skilled employees like electricians, in order to de-skill jobs so they can pay less. But to me, that short-term thinking we should be thinking in a progressive tax system is guaranteed income. If AI replaces everybody, then there's nobody buying what they're selling anymore. Okay? So they want to stay rich. They want to keep selling products and services. Well, people have to have an income. So if AI is going to go as far as they're predicting, as opposed to just certain industries, that it's going to have to be a conversation in all high-income democracies.
Yeah, I mean what Jim is talking about is its own separate conversation. And it's a question of if it does go as far, as Jim says, as they're saying, this society doesn't survive without an entirely new economic system, starting with a UBI. It is impossible.
Yes.
You can't put 80 or 60 or 70% of people out of work entirely and then just tell them good luck on the art that you're going to work on now. And by the way, AI is creating art. So now you're competing with AI as well. It doesn't really work. That's its own conversation. Part of what I think, Jim, is when we're promised that AI can do all these good things, and we're going to talk in a couple of weeks on this program about how it could very well, very soon, be detecting cancer at earlier and earlier stages, less invasively. That's wonderful. It could help with climate change. That would be wonderful. But why then is so much of the emphasis on AI, on figuring out how to replace you and me?
Well, again, it's all about—
It doesn't have to be, but that's
right.
A choice, isn't it?
It's all about the bottom line. I mean, some things, if you've had any surgery in the last 20 years, I'm much more comfortable with some of the AI that does intricate surgery.
Sure.
Than the human who's shaking like a leaf, okay? So some of these things—
Surgeons,
could be
he doesn't mean all of you.
Yes. But I go back to when I was 13 years old, and it's still in some movies, like space movies. We had a World's Fair in Seattle. And it was there was a pavilion of the future, and we had the new 1964 Mustang, and we had the house where you had the video phone, and everything was automated, and it would eliminate all the labor in the future, and the housewife wouldn't have to do any work. And so we've heard a lot of these promises before.
Yeah, Orlando, when I hear a CEO boast about 90% of their workforce is gone thanks to AI— what I think is we've all, at least in journalism circles, been talking about that as a possible worst-case scenario. CEOs might view that as a best-case scenario, and that is something we should be aware of because they have a lot of power. So we can talk about, well, if the worst-case scenario and how many layoffs, but if the management class thinks in the best-case scenario, how many layoffs can we get? Then we've got to have some answers here. But I don't know how you feel about AI and its future.
Well, based off of, who we represent, I'll stick to what I know most certainly is our local, right? You're talking about a lot of hands-on, skilled labor workers. It would affect us in some sort of way. I can't say that I can see an AI sitting behind a 40,000-pound plow truck, but... when we talk about our clerical staff and stuff like that, it's definitely something that can come to reality sooner than later. Mm-hmm. I mean, we sit back. I remember watching the Jetsons and thinking 2020 we'd have flying cars and all that stuff. I never heard nothing about AI till as of recent. And it's quite scary to sit back and think that we could lose, our economy system based off of the AI intelligence that's out there now and will be facing in the near future. But it's scary to think of. I don't know much about it. To be honest with you, I don't really pay attention too far into it. But as far as, concerned about what it can do to labor in the near future, I mean, it can really put a deficit on this country, if we let it get to a certain extent that, we're replacing our human lives with robots.
Yeah. Sharifa, what do you think?
Yeah, I definitely have to echo to what Orlando was saying, because that is a scary situation that someone would, just say, oh, well, we can just, eliminate 90% of our workforce like that. I think back to, the movie that we're showing tonight, and like you were saying earlier about the dignity of workforce and the workers, and just saying, well, you're just replaceable. That's just not the dignity that we want to show to our workers out there, that they're just replaceable because there's this new technology that's out there.
Let me get a phone call from Jane in Rochester. Has taken a look at something that happened in Texas. Hi, Jane. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was hoping you wouldn't go to AI today.
Sorry, Jane.
because I wanted to call in and here's my monster conversation. But on this thing with the walkers, you would not want to vote Republican if you think unions are beneficial and so forth, because the Republican Party is trying to take OSHA to a chopping block, so to speak, that would, you know, guarantee that the employer is responsible for having safe working conditions. It makes me sick. And they're always saying, we're going to get rid of all these regulations and rules and laws. And they're not thinking about us at all. They just want more money. And it just kills me. It was, you know, if you remember back in the summer, one of the hottest summers we've ever had, and they had various people. It seems like some of them were migrants.
Oh, we lost you for. I'm sorry, Jane. We lost you there. Jane is talking about an issue in Texas last summer when farm workers were denied taking a water break, and reading reports that. Texas Governor Abbott approved a law eliminating local laws that protect water breaks for outdoor workers, many of whom are Hispanic in Texas. And so there were allegations that that was not only anti-workers, but there was a racial component. Governor Abbott says that's not the case. But the Texas Tribune says that the bill in question passed in June of 2023 and went into effect last September. So no mandated water breaks for outdoor workers, even in the Texas summers, many of whom are Hispanic. So I don't know much about it. I'm trying to kind of fact check on the fly. That's Jane's concern. I don't know if you're aware of that, Jim.
Yeah, but it's like everything else. It's where the Republican Party has moved to. When Eisenhower was running for a second term, I was already in grammar school. If you looked at Eisenhower's platform, in 1956, you would think it was the Democratic Party platform. Support for unions, protecting the right to join the union, protecting Social Security, Medicare. He said, anybody who would oppose Social Security and unions these days, it doesn't make sense. He was against Brown v. Board of Education because he didn't think the South would buy it and there'd be trouble. But when the Supreme Court ruled unanimously, he sent the troops to Little Rock when they tried to stop integration. Baloney, rule of law. I mean, so, you know, someone who came up and began going to school in the 50s, the Republican Party today, it has no resemblance to where it was
okay,
under an Eisenhower.
But, Jim, I'm looking at Bloomberg News data right here. In 2016... Hillary Clinton wins union households by only 8.5 points nationwide. 2020, Joe Biden wins union households 57-40. So he doubled Clinton's margin. So Biden did better in 2020 than Clinton did in 2016 with unions. But in both of those years, Trump won union households in Ohio and Pennsylvania. Ohio is no longer even really a swing state. That's my native state. Pennsylvania is very much so. So if what you're describing is the sentiment that... If that were more common, Trump wouldn't be winning union households in Ohio and Pennsylvania.
This is a bigger problem, and you talked about civil rights and labor. One of the things Martin Luther King used to say when going to conventions, that the racist, the white supremacist, is a two-headed creature. Out of one head, they speak racist epithets. Out of the other head, they scream anti-union propaganda. The National Right to Work Committee Farm post-World War II included a John Bircher and the Texas head of the Ku Klux Klan. We say in the labor movement, and we got this from Martin Luther King and Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huertas from the farm workers, that workers' rights and civil rights are the same struggle, the struggle for human rights. And that's when things started to go nuts. The National Right to Work Committee really hated unions because, and if you heard the one, this original member of the National Right to Work Committee, they're going to have your white wife working with a black guy and calling him brother. It was all still about Jim Crow.
This was happening when?
This has happened just post-World War II, and Taft-Hartley pass by the National Truman.
So you're saying
Truman
those were the scare tactics.
Yeah, Truman vetoed it. And the other thing that people need to remember, and you can't take any election for granted, 1965, the Voting Rights Act passes. Supposedly everybody's got an equal right to vote. The majority of white voters in this country have not voted for a Democrat for president since 1965. Hopefully that changes this year. That's why turnout and all the rest. So, again, I told you I had a flashback last week going back to George Wallace being endorsed in 1968. People need to remember who don't show up to vote that we have not had a majority of white voters vote for a Democratic president since Lyndon B. Baines Johnson in 1964. He was the last one.
Sharifa, I guess I'm wondering if it surprises you that union households in a swing state like Pennsylvania would go for the Republican candidate and Donald Trump, and if you think that could happen again.
Well, like I said before.
And again, it was slim margin, by the way. Slim margin, but still, yeah.
I don't hold nothing, nothing surprises me, in this day in life. So anything could happen. I think that what is best is, people to just, educate on what the issues are that is out there and just look at what is really happening in this world so they can best make the best decisions that's out there and what really is affecting, the whole country.
Orlando, same question. What do you think?
Same, I want to piggyback off of that. I think more Americans need to educate themselves more so on, what parties they choose or what presidential candidate they push behind. I really don't like to get in the mix of politics too much, but it's safe to say that nowadays, anything can happen, I guess you could say. So yeah. I kind of leave it on that edge.
Okay. Do you have, by the way, union brothers and sisters who vote differently than you? Do you talk about it?
We really don't get into it too much. We kind of try to keep, our personal opinions and thoughts out of when it comes to relating politics to, local union work locally. For the most part, we have people who are very full-blown Democratic supporters, and then you have some on the other sides that are full-blown Republican supporters as well. So we get a little mixture of both, to be honest.
Well, and on the subject of the solidarity of labor, I was saying to Jim Bertolone before the show, Jim's the president emeritus of the Rochester Labor Council and a former president and labor historian for APWU. Just a couple Fridays ago on this program, there was a bit of an internecine union kind of scuffle when electrical workers represented on this program said that they did not want to see a study about a public utility, that they backed RG&E. And yet we had phone calls from people who work in other labor circles saying that goes against where we have largely been. And do you think labor split on that? Do you think, look, that's up to the electrical workers?
No. The history, especially public employee unions, most of us have fought our entire union careers against privatization. And this really begins with the Lewis Powell memo, who was later rewarded with a Supreme Court seat at the end of the 70s and the end of Ronald Reagan, where Ronald Reagan says, the government's the problem. People have a right that their taxes are used for their benefit. Part of the transfer of wealth, and since Ronald Reagan has elected, and you can find this out there, we have seen $50 trillion since 1981, transferred from 90% of Americans to the richest 10%. Privatization was part of that. Oh, the private sector can do it better, they can do it cheaper, and what we've seen is what we've seen here, where RG&E now grabs $150 million a year from our employers, our businesses, and our working people and our members and puts it in their pockets and the shareholders' pockets.
So what's going on with the electrical workers who say they're fine with RG&E?
Well, they got a good contract, and I understand that. So and I'm sure, you know, I don't want to think ill of any, that their union representative and his members, you know, they negotiated a good contract with a good raise, and he is elected by his members. So, you know, that's the narrow vision. But there is a big picture out there, and privatization has meant, and not just in the defense industry, that we have paid more and more for less and less service, and the workers have been paid less and less to transfer the wealth to the top.
Let me just, I want to turn to Sharifa and get back to what brought us here, which is the showing of the film tonight, a documentary film about an hour long called At the River I Stand. It's at the cinema. The cinema theater will have it at 5:30 tonight. And I know our guests would love to see you there if you can be there. If you know a little bit about this story, it is there's a lot more to it than I realized. And I hadn't gone deep on it until our guests were going to appear on this program. And I did some reading and I just found so much of this story remarkable about the sanitation workers in Memphis, the support from not only Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but what really became a movement after the assassination of Dr. King, but also after the death of two workers. Here's how NPR describes how things happened after the assassination. Quote, King's assassination brought deep mourning and civil unrest to cities around the country. In Memphis, the sanitation workers' struggle continued with the added support of King's widow, Coretta Scott King. A few days after King's assassination, she and other leaders returned to Memphis's streets to support the workers, and the efforts finally paid off. President Lyndon B. Johnson sent James Reynolds, his Undersecretary of Labor, to Memphis to help resolve the strike. Nearly 2 weeks later, on April 16, 1968, the city agreed to grant raises to African-American employees and recognize the workers' union. End quote. What is the most important part of the story that you want listeners to understand if they really didn't know the involvement of Dr. King and all of the struggle that happened for those workers, Sharifa?
I want workers in the community to know that it's not was, you know, what we have seen in the history of Martin Luther King on the balcony of Lorraine Motel and everyone pointing to, you know, to the building. It's not just that picture, that there was the backstory of why he was there, and that the progress that he started, that it finished even after his death. And I want the community to know that we are still in that struggle, that we are still fighting for the equal rights of workers. There's still more that needs to be done, but we are still here. I think it's very important for the community to know that his work was just not in vain. He just wasn't there just to make speeches and then just leave. He was there to actually do some work.
Orlando Torres, what do you want people to understand about this story?
I think we need to focus back on the big picture of solidarity. I think solidarity is a huge thing when it comes to labor movement. You know, the stronger we are in numbers, the bigger we are in numbers, the stronger we stay. It's important for people to recognize that Dr. King went there to support these people during their times of need, and that, you know, the labor movement was based off of individuals holding hands and walking side by side in what they believed in and continued to fight for what was right for, you know, equal wages and benefits and therefore. But, you know, solidarity is a huge thing in the labor movement, and it's important that people understand that, you know, if, as long as we stay together, whether, you know, no matter what color our skin is or what our beliefs are, but if we're working side by side and we're brothers in labor, that we should always continue to support one another.
And about 30 seconds, what could fracture that solidarity today?
I think, to be honest with you, unfortunately, we're dealing with the rise of, I don't want to call them millennials, but it's hard because nobody realizes the depth behind the movement of labor. And I think it's something that we need to focus so much more on, because, you know, nowadays people think so much stuff is just handed to you by whether it's municipalities or private sectors or whatever the case you're unionized in. But we need to focus on some, at some point in time, people fought for what you're being given.
And Jim Bertolone, what do you hope listeners take from that?
Actually, wedge issues are always used to divide us, especially race. But I'm encouraged that something like 70, every poll we've taken in the last few years, people under 30 support labor unions and like 78%. It's unheard of since the early 60s when one out of every three people belonged to a labor.
So can you translate that into bigger union numbers in the future?
I believe so. I think we've seen it with better contracts. I think we've seen a breakthrough in the South where a majority of workers have voted for the UAW at a Mercedes-Benz plant, and it looks like the same thing may happen if Volkswagen. We're seeing it nationwide with Starbucks and all kinds of industries, low-paid workers, retail, that would never attempted to organize before. And I think we also have to address, again, race. There are exceptions to every rule. Maybe there's a black person who hates all white people just for their white. I've never met him in my life. But there is no such thing as white reverse discrimination and discrimination against whites. It's just not a thing. Standing up to your oppressor is not discrimination. Jews who enlisted in the army in World War II to go fight the Germans were not reverse discrimination against the Germans. It's absurd on its face. And those are the things that keep us divided.
If you want to learn more about some of these issues tonight at 5:30 at the Cinema Theater, it's At the River I Stand, the story of the sanitation workers of Memphis, the solidarity with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in his final days, the speech he made the night before his assassination. And I want to thank our guest, Jim Bertolone. Thank you for being here, sir.
Thank you, Evan.
Our thanks to Orlando Torres, Vice President of AFSCME Local 1635.
Thank you
for being here. And Sharifa Pryor, Chair of the Rochester Labor Council Racial Justice Committee. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
More connections coming up.